we're talking about new ways scientists are using to inform their research, how humans are evolving maybe the wrong way, and other headlines with our science expert Gemma Tarlak. Gemma's senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to give us the stories behind headlines in the science world. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. How about you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Well, we're going to start off by talking about the way the science of sound is revolutionizing research in the science world. What's going on with sound?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story because, you know, we don't think of all the different ways, of all the different sounds out there and how they might actually be applicable to research. And there's a whole range of projects. I'll just mention a couple of my favorites. They are looking at the ultra-low frequency sound waves that are emitted by gases within stars. And they're finding that they can use these sound waves to measure how old the stars are relative to each other and all these different traits, because the sound waves actually show up as rhythmic changes in brightness and temperature. And this is just, you know, you would never think, how can I, you know, hear the sound of the stars and learn about them? But it's an actual practice that they're doing and getting a lot of great data with. So that's kind of a, you know, way out there, literally, application. but then one much closer to home, you know, if you're a birder or a fan of seabirds, you know that they tend not to build colonies in the most accessible places, you know, like a sea rock out in the middle of nowhere, such. Well, it's really hard to monitor how big the colonies are and how healthy they are if you got to take the rowboat, you know, miles out to sea or whatever. But now they're finding they can just put a microphone in the seabird colony and just by the sound alone monitor the size and health of the colony, which is not only a great way to get data, but, you know, I mean, your tax dollars at work, they're being thrifty, folks.
First of all, it's amazing that gases from stars have a sound. I would never have thought that was something that scientists could study. But once you get past that, I mean, is this essentially, can this yield research with measurable results, or is it always going to be sort of a spitball kind of thing if you're using sound?
Oh, no. I mean, these are definitely legitimate results, and it's legitimate data. And it's just, you know, if you think about looking at an image through a telescope and you see it fluctuate, say, in brightness, well, you're looking at it and you're using the sight of something to get data. This is basically the same thing. It's just instead of sight, you're using sound. So it's absolutely legitimate research, and some have even had findings. For example, the caterpillars. Can I talk about the caterpillar study? I love it. So researchers at the University of Missouri played a recording of munching caterpillars, just caterpillars going yum, 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 yum. And they played it next to these plants, and they found that when the plants heard the sound of the caterpillars, they released larger amounts of naturally occurring anti-insect chemicals than the control group that didn't get to hear the munching caterpillars. And so that, you know, that's an actual result, and they can use it in agricultural research and just learning more about how plants function. So plants can apparently, you know, hear caterpillars at least.
Yeah, there's so much. We could spend the whole amount of our time on these munching caterpillars and plants thing. But we should move on to our next story now. A big story about disevolution. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that properly, but how humans are passing dysfunctional genes on to the next generation. What's going on with that?
Yeah, this is actually our cover story, and it's the true story of our writer, Jeff Wheelwright, who went bravely to see this evolutionary biologist who is looking at disevolution. That's D-Y-S, evolution. And it's the idea that, you know, for millions of years, our ancestors developed very slowly. Natural selection took place. If there was a mutation that put out a great trait that gave us an advantage, cool. We evolved to have that trait. But if it didn't work out, it kind of fell by the wayside. And it never really became, excuse me, part of our species. So natural selection takes a long time. And that was pretty much what our species has been doing until about 10,000 years ago when agriculture kicked in. We went from being hunter-gatherers to a much more sedentary population that used farming for our main means of food production. That caused some problems, and he calls that a cultural evolutionary switch. But even more problems arose after the Industrial Revolution. When you think of how much our lives have changed, not just in the past 10,000 years, but just in the past couple centuries, natural selection and sort of natural biological evolution has not kept up at all with cultural evolution. That's why we have eyeglasses and flat feet and all these other problems, obesity, etc., that are just really taking a, you know, taking a toll on our species. We haven't had time to adapt to it all.
So what does that mean long run? Does that mean that these traits stick around forever and don't get weeded out, or that it just takes a lot longer?
Well, that is, you know, the $64,000 question or so. And the researcher is actually advocating for us to do as much as we can to prevent these problems. For example, you know, back in the day, hunter-gatherers had a sweet tooth because it was a very nutrient-rich source of food for them. Nowadays, you know, with a fast food shop on every corner, et cetera, we should be staying away from sweets because, for us, they cause obesity and cavities and all these other problems that our ancestors didn't have. So he's saying, you know, let's look at where disevolution mismatches have cropped up, and let's try to do something preventively about them. For example, back in the day, we got a lot of exercise running around, chasing game, looking for food, etc. Nowadays, we're very, very sedentary, so we really need to amp up the amount of physical activity we do. And it's little changes like that, but, you know, when you read the whole story and how he kind of analyzed our writer and all the things that he was doing wrong, it's just kind of a wake-up call. Like, if you haven't laced up your running shoes yet, this story is going to make you want to do it.
Well, we're talking about some new science headlines right now out of Discover Magazine with Gemma Tarlak. And before we leave this story, Gemma, he has something to say about the paleo diet. Now, this presumably would be something our ancestors did and therefore maybe a good selective thing to do. What's the take on that?
Well, yeah, you know, one of the interesting things he says about the paleo diet, for example, if you sit down to a nice big plate of 21st century vegetables, as, you know, our hunter-gatherer forebears did, you know what? You're not going to get the same nutrients. You're not going to get the same amount of fiber, et cetera, as they did when they sat down to, you know, a nice big pile of vegetables. And that's because as we've domesticated vegetables over time, we selected out for some of the nutritious things in favor of some of the tastier things. You know, for example, a lot of vegetables have much less fiber than they did centuries ago because, oh, fiber, it's hard to chew, takes a long time, whatever. But, ooh, look at this nice, soft, mushy potato or turnip. Mmm, delicious. So even if you try to recreate the paleo diet, you're not going to do it. And he comes out pretty strongly against the paleo diet as this kind of returning back to nature. He's got several good reasons for that.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap up with a story about Google Earth changing the way archaeology is practiced. Obviously, Google Earth has a lot of applications. What is it doing to this field?
Well, you know, it's been 10 years since Google Earth has been out there available to anyone, and professional archaeologists do not use it that much. They might use it for some logistical planning, but they have much more advanced forms of imagery that can really help them pinpoint what they're looking for. At the same time, the availability of Google Earth has turned up this whole big field of amateur archaeologists who are going out there and making some pretty amazing finds. One of the people I interviewed for the story, Peter Welsh from England, he and his group just found one of the largest coin hoards ever found in, you know, the English countryside. And fortunately, he's on the up and up, and he made sure that as soon as they found that discovery, they called in an archaeologist who helped excavate it properly so the context could be recorded, which is crucial in archaeology. And then all the coins are actually now at the British Museum being cleaned and hopefully put on display. So he did all that. He started with Google Earth, but there are a lot of armchair archaeologists out there who maybe aren't so up on the up and up. And, you know, it's tempting. If you're hiking along and you see an arrowhead or a shard of pottery or whatever, you pick it up, think, oh, this is cool. Well, as soon as you pick it up, you pretty much ruin it, because in archaeology, the context is everything. It's where was it found, what was it found next to, and what layer of the soil. So even though there are some armchair archaeologists who are doing it right, and we introduce you to a few of them in the story, professional archaeologists are kind of wringing their hands about people who just kind of blunder in using Google Earth. So while it's attracting a lot of interest into the archaeology field, it's also stirring up a lot of controversy.
And we leave it there, Gemma. Fun as always. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. You take care.
We've been speaking with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She's with us every month to talk about the latest from the world of science.